Hello and welcome to the Mother Earth News Online Homesteading Summit. This is Marjorie Wildcraft, your host. Our next presentation is by Jason Matthias, and he's going to be talking about some of the traps of homesteading and pitfalls and how you can avoid them.
Thank you, Marjorie, for that introduction, and thanks so much for having me be on this Mother Earth News Summit event. I'm greatly appreciative of the opportunity to present this session on top traps of homesteading and how to avoid them. A little bit about me. My name is Jason Matthias. I am a husband and father of seven kids from 12 down to 2. We are a homesteading family, a homeschooling family. I was raised in Southern California in the garden, so I grew up in the garden my whole life, and I'm doing the same with my kids, teaching them skills of self-reliance and understanding just how valuable real food is and how hard it is to grow and produce. My background, I spent 11 years active duty in the Air Force. I was a KC-10 pilot. Here's a picture of KC-10s refueling each other over Afghanistan. Also spent a few years working with the Army before I left active duty. And while that lifestyle was exciting, it wasn't the lifestyle I wanted for my family. I really wanted to have a lifestyle that was allowed me to spend time with my family, to be involved in my children's education, to teach them especially hard work ethic and kind of a much more traditional lifestyle of being in an environment where they not only were with their parents and with each other, but were given responsibilities such as caring for animals and learning family business principles together as well. So I left active duty, went into the reserves, and I've been pursuing a path of entrepreneurship for almost the past decade. That path has led me to being involved with the Beyond Off Grid Project. If you're not already aware of us, the Beyond Off Grid Project is a documentary film, is what it started as, but has expanded into other media production. And our purpose is to educate and inspire you about why you should reduce your dependence on the modern economy and how you can seek true freedom by returning to the old paths of productive households and local community interdependence. And many people in this audience are, you are probably kind of already on this bandwagon, so to speak. So I'm kind of preaching to the choir, but you might have friends and family that don't really get it. And that's one of the purposes of the film, is to give you a tool to help bring up some of these topics about the unsustainable nature of modern economy, the ways that it entraps us, and how going back to these older traditional ways of living, that's the answer, that's the solution, is lifestyle change. And so we hope this can be a resource to you. So we hope that you might be involved as our film is released soon in getting the word out to other people. In the film, we interviewed a great many homesteaders, including Michael Bunker, who's the author of the book Surviving Off-Grid, which that book was a large inspiration for the film itself. And Michael provided a lot of great insights, not only big picture, but also into his homesteading lifestyle and the self-sufficiency that he and his family and community have built. Franklin Sanders, who is a mentor of mine, has been a homesteader for nearly 2 decades now. And he, with his children, actually as a family, intergenerationally, have returned to the land. And he's also a precious metals expert and a financial analyst. And so he understands the unsustainability of the modern system. And that's one of the reasons that he went back to the country. And so we got a lot of good insights from him as well in the film. We also interviewed Jim Smith, who's the founder of the Back to the Land store in Central Tennessee, which I highly recommend you visit if you ever are near Nashville. And Paul Wheaton, of course, many of you know him. He's actually teaching sessions in this event as well. Paul, we interviewed talking about permaculture and some of the other things that he's involved with. And so we interviewed a variety of people, most of whom were homesteaders for the film. But as we began post-production on the film after the interviews were complete, we wanted to continue delivering and really, before the film even came out, give value to our audience and to grow our audience and to be able to help train people and inspire people on this lifestyle change that we're talking about with these people in the film interviews. And so we started a series of online training webinars, and actually her very first one was with Marjorie. Very appreciative of the contribution she made. She actually talked about her trip to Cuba and how their food system collapsed and how they dealt with it and lessons learned from that. We've also had Scott Hunt, who is a off-grid energy and water expert, on several times to teach. So had a number of experts and homesteaders deliver through online presentation to help inspire and equip people. Last year, we really focused our training on self-reliance and homesteading with our Beyond Off-Grid Summit training series, and we included homesteaders like the Homestead Lady, Tessa Zundell, Lori Neverman, who's been involved in this event as well, my friend Noah Sanders, who is a farmer and homesteader in Alabama, as well as Tammy Traer, you may know of, out in Idaho, who have an off-grid homestead there. We also interviewed people that maybe aren't homesteading but have expertise in critical areas, like Alex Summerall, who's a natural building instructor, and Sharon Peterson, who teaches about canning on simplycanning.com. And we did this online training series all last year on all these topics to help equip people to make this lifestyle change that's so important and that you are obviously either interested in or already implementing. We took it to one level beyond that, and we actually had a live training event. And we had this live training event at a very unique place. It's a homestead and farm in the mountains of Virginia, west of Roanoke, in the western part of the state. And we gathered a number of homesteaders and experts from around the country, as well as a lot of attendees there to learn from them in the context of this relatively new homestead that's being built from the ground up. The host is my friend Josh Deal, who's he and his family have been building this homestead for a number of years now. He was one of the instructors, and he's a permaculture instructor as well as a bandsaw mill operator and a bunch of other stuff. Noah Sanders, my friend who's written the book Born Again Dirt, which is a must read for any homesteader, particularly if you're a person of faith. We also had Ben Harris, who's a horse logger and was featured on the TV show Axemen, as well as my farmer friend Mike Bravo from Missouri, who's a organic CSA farmer there. These and other homesteaders and experts gathered together talking about topics like homestead planning, building soil, how to grow with low technology tools, and how to manage woodlot and other homestead resources. Now, why am I telling you about all this? The reason I'm telling you this is because all of these people that we've either interviewed or had online training sessions with, dozens and dozens of them, they have a vast plethora of experience that I've been in a unique position as the producer of the film and the producer of this training series to glean insights from. And so this presentation is really a culmination of and combination of all of the insights that they have delivered through the various interviews for the film and the training that we've done. I'd like to kick this off with a quote from Amber Bradshaw, who taught a training session in our summit series about natural cleaning products. She said, "Do your best until you know better, and when you know better, do better." And I think this is really good. It gives us some insight as to how we can seek excellence without seeking perfection, which we know we'll never attain, and usually it leads to immobilization or paralysis, the old analysis paralysis, right, that we've heard of. And so the purpose of this presentation really is to take this thought and to help you learn from others early in your journey so that you can know better and you can do better earlier in your journey. In other words, gather the wisdom from others to help avoid some of the very costly mistakes that they have made or have seen others make along the way. All right, so the top traps of homesteading and how to avoid them. Let's get started with the first one. The first trap is not taking a long view. The tendency from our modern thinking is to be short-sighted. At our summit live training event, our host, Josh Deal, who, as I said, is not only a homesteader and farmer, but a permaculture designer, had some great perspective on how we should be thinking about our homesteading and developing our land and taking a long view into the future.
Another question is, what are your plans for the property? What are your plans for the property? If you have any plans for yourself, or like Franklin Sanders is talking about, a 100-year plan for your family homestead or farm, what might your children or grandchildren want to do with this property? Is it something that they potentially could use for cottage industries like cattle or sheep or goats, or something maybe you have no interest in at all, but as you pass on and pass the torch, maybe they'll pick up that interest?
So to take a long view, it's important that we think intergenerationally, right? Don't just think about ourselves and what we want in this generation, but it's important to look forward multiple generations. And I would recommend, I think that the best time frame to be thinking is 100 years. 100 years forward, which is 3 or 4 generations, perhaps 5. And if we think on that kind of time horizon, it gives us a perspective that will help us make wiser decisions, not only for us in our lifetime, but also for our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren. So some questions to ask as you go about thinking this process, you know, what are your plans for the property? Like, what do you kind of envision for them? And then ask after that, you know, what could your children or your grandchildren want to do with your property and the resources you're developing on it and the infrastructure that you're building? Could they use the land, the resources, the infrastructure you're building for cottage industries, particularly for cottage industries that you are not currently pursuing and maybe have no plans to pursue during your lifetime? If we ask these questions, it will help us to be able to make choices that don't bind our progeny, our descendants, and gives them more flexibility to do things that maybe we didn't even envision. But if we can see possibilities in the future, it helps us make wise decisions that gives them a platform upon which they can build in the future. They can stand better upon our shoulders, so to speak. Joel Salatin, I've heard him speak a number of times when he's talking about this issue of farming intergenerationally, and the fact that the average age of the American farmer is in the 60s now. And in most cases, their children are not interested in farming anymore. Joel makes the point that one of the reasons for this is because past generations of farmers have made decisions about developing their farm that really tied the hands of future generations, making it very difficult to transition to other forms of agriculture, particularly to sustainable forms of agriculture, because they built inflexible infrastructure like grain silos, or they're buying single-use equipment like massive, you know, multi-hundred-thousand-dollar harvesters and combines, things that cannot do other things. They can only do one thing, and they can do it at a vast scale, but they can't do small-scale stuff, and they're not flexible. These infrastructure and technology and resource purchasing decisions made by past generations oftentimes make it actually financially unviable to continue farming. And the same thing ends up happening with homesteading as well. So as you're thinking about how you're planning your homestead, particularly as it relates to infrastructure development, think about multi-use. Think about how is what I'm doing potentially constraining my children or my grandchildren and what they might want to do in the future. And if we think about those things up front, we're going to make much wiser decisions that, again, create a much broader and stronger foundation upon which future generations can stand. It's important that we start with the end in mind, right? So if we, one of the reasons that we're homesteading is because we want to produce most, or hope maybe even potentially all of our own food. It's important that we think about that and what it's going to take to get there. So the temptation often when we get started with something is getting wrapped up in all the busyness of doing the first things that need to be done. And our thinking in the modern age is very short-sighted. So it's important that as we think about planning our homestead or maybe expanding our property, whatever we're going to do with it, that we don't get stuck in short-term thinking, but that we focus on long-term investments And even though they may cost more now, particularly in terms of time, and the benefit of it may be delayed somewhat, that over time, the rewards that will come back on and the return on that investment will be much greater. So it's important you ask yourself, what do you want to achieve with your homestead and with the production from your homestead? So start with the end in mind and help that guide the investments that you make in time, money, and resources. A good example of this is planting fruit and nut trees. You can buy more mature trees that obviously will produce sooner, but in any case, if you plant a tree that is, you know, a year or two old, it's going to take 5 to 10 years probably before it really starts producing significant amount of fruit. However, in a decade or two down the road, the amount of food that that tree will produce is going to be huge. So the return in the future is going to be exceedingly great compared to the amount of effort and cost that you're putting in up front. And because of the time that it takes for trees to develop and to mature and to really produce lots of food, it's important that we look at doing these kind of investments early on. Another one that doesn't take as long on a time horizon, but similarly, focusing on perennial food crops. So things like berries and brambles and other perennial food crops like Jerusalem artichokes and other things like this. Things that need very little tending, it's important that we look to work with and set up systems that mature on their own without a lot of our effort to maintain them and without a lot of expensive external inputs to maintain them or to achieve like optimal production. These are the kind of things that we should be focusing our efforts on. And again, these are all kind of permaculture principles that we should try to implement. Wise stewardship, it's again, thoughtful planning on the front end, wise investments on the front end that reap outsized returns later on. Another example of this is, again, a permaculture principle, is harnessing natural processes to our benefit. Things like creating swales or berms on slopes to capture and fully utilize the rainfall and water resources that the property that we have receives. Also installing ponds and other forms of water retention is a good example, and Joel Salatin talks a lot about this. They've invested a lot of resources and money into digging ponds up in the hills above their property, and by doing so, they're able to ensure that they have gravity-fed water to their entire farm year-round, even in dry seasons. And so they don't have to have electricity to pump water around because it's gravity-fed from high elevation. Another principle that you can apply is for food production, trying to focus on producing easily preserved produce to reduce the amount of work required on the back end, on the processing end. And so examples of this would be winter squash or root crops that you harvest them, and if they're properly cured and stored, can last for months and months. Again, that's why winter squash are called winter squash, because they last through the winter. You don't have to process them immediately like you would with tomatoes or cucumbers or something that's gonna rot, because it stores in proper storage conditions for a long time, which reduces the work required that you have to do in the harvest season. And so this is a way that we can plan our food production to help reduce the amount of work required and help conserve some of our energy and our attention and our time to focus on these other things that we need to be looking at. A really important principle more of a pattern of thinking that we really need to do is to think sustainability. Okay, now sustainability is a term that's thrown around a lot, but what I mean by this in particular is looking at how we can use the lowest form of technology or the simplest form of technology possible to accomplish a given objective. So an example from this picture, is a picture of lumber that was milled off of the homestead that it is being used for construction on to build a barn. So instead of paying top dollar for steel structures in the tens of or even hundreds of thousands of dollars to build a really nice barn, consider using resources you have, like timber on your property. And if you can hire a local bandsaw mill operator to mill your logs that you've cut down out of your woods into lumber, even if you have to hire some labor to build the barn, you're going to be having a significant cost savings on the building materials for that project. And so when we're building infrastructure, look for ways to be more sustainable in our sourcing of materials. And also look at, in terms of designing structures and designing systems, think sustainability, think the lowest technology possible. A good example of this are water catchment systems and gravity distribution systems for water. Instead of using electrical pumps to pump water out of a well and to distribute it where it needs to go, use gravity instead, if you can, if that's possible on your property. That's one reason why property with some elevation is helpful. If you can't do that, look at things like a solar power pump, but realizing that a solar powered pump, still anything electrical, is going to need to be repaired or replaced at some point in the future. So the simpler the better. Water catchment, water storage, gravity feed for distribution is the ideal here, and is an example of sustainability as far as the application of technology. One other example is passive solar heating for houses. A lot of people will heat with wood that they harvest off their property, which is great, and that's a sustainable solution. However, it is time consuming. So if you can design your structure to capture and retain heat from the sun, you're going to reduce the amount of external inputs for heat, such as wood. And so smart design can save tons of money, time, and effort in the long run when you consider the years and decades of wood harvesting and wood processing to chop it and split it up into size that you can fit in your wood stove and stack it and dry it and cure it and all that stuff. That's just a lot of work. So if you can reduce the amount that you have to do that through design of your structure through something like passive solar, that is a fantastic option. Another great low-tech heating option you should consider are things like Paul Wheaton's actually teaching about in this summit, with things like rocket mass stoves and other types of technology like that. Great ways to reduce the amount of fuel required to heat a given space. Another thing we should be looking for in terms of thinking sustainability is reclaiming a lot of old-fashioned skills and trying to learn those skills, things like blacksmithing. Even things like time-proven methods of stewardship. A good example of this is when you're talking about woodlot management and harvesting timber sustainably. We had a great session by Ben Harris, the horse logger I mentioned earlier, at our live training event that talked about this, that I'd like to show you real quick and give you an example of how older methods of management can be a very modern application of this principle of sustainability.
Trees are like stocks. If they're increasing in value, we want to leave them. We want to catch them right before they drop, right before they start that drop. So at least for to achieve maximum return on it. That tree still has a number of years before it reaches its climax and starts going downhill. And eventually they will, after, it depends on the site, specifically what that point is, but a tree will just get too old and just start dying slowly over time. And that's where you want to catch a tree. So ultimately the goal is to be able to harvest every tree. That's what you're not wanting to leave them just to leave them. The goal is to be able to harvest them eventually. The longer you think about your management time frame, the more better return you're looking at. If I'm looking at my kids' lives, my grandkids' lives, if I do things right, my grandkids would be a whole lot better off than I am. That's how you need to think about it. Really, that's what needs to be done, in my opinion, generally, with forest management. I want to be thinking, because, the forests are here. I mean, they're here to stay. A forest will grow just fine without us. 100 years from now, it's going to be more diverse. You're going to have what we're looking for. All we're trying to do is speed up the process that nature does anyway, and be able to use it for our goals. The forest doesn't need us. It'll fix itself over time. But since we need the forest for, you know, all the products that we use it for, then what we need to try to do is just imitate what the nature's already doing.
Our next top trap is not having a solid financial plan. And this is probably one of the most dangerous ones, because people often don't really count the cost or don't realize how costly a homesteading effort can be. Franklin Sanders, who I mentioned earlier, we interviewed for our film, and he is also taught on some of our online trainings. He was also a guest at our live training event. He provides some great thoughts in this on his welcome session at our live training event that I'd like to share with you.
One of the things that I have to mention is you've got to live in reality. Whatever you're going to do, you have to be able to make a living at it. It may be that, you know, the only thing you can do is move out in the country and become part of a community and still work, sort of commute by computer, and that's fine, but you have to make a living at what you're doing. You can't start a farm like this, and anybody who started one knows it's a dollars and cents business, and if it's not self-sustaining, it won't work. You won't be there. You won't last very long.
So this is important. Don't have your head in the clouds. Be very conservative in your planning and your estimates. Everything takes longer than you hope and costs a lot more than you plan. We kind of know this from our life experience, even in the modern world, right? But when you throw in all of the things in a return to the old paths, so to speak, things like weather and seasonal differences in growing patterns and animals getting out or disease or all these other things that happen that we're kind of insulated from in the modern world, these things can often create for great variances in the time it takes to accomplish things as well as the costs involved. So be very conservative in your planning, and just, you know, don't have your head in the clouds and think that everything's going to go exactly according to plan. Give yourself margin. Very important. Here's an important one. If you are planning on building a homestead products business, whether it is direct-to-market vegetables or meat or jams and jellies, it's important to realize that it takes a long time and a lot of effort to build a customer base in a local market. And I know this firsthand from experience, because one of the things that I do in my entrepreneurial pursuits as a business consultant is I have a good number of clients that are small farms and direct-to-market food producers. And my family has even done this to some extent with ourselves. It takes a lot longer than you would hope, often, to build a customer base in a local market. And so it's important that you're very conservative when you're going about a business venture like this, to be conservative in your revenue projections, particularly in the growth of your customer base, and take into account larger factors. Particularly one that's in operation right now is the macroeconomic factor of the economy is really bad, and people aren't as willing to spend more on high quality products because their budgets are pinched and discretionary income is limited. So take that into account as you plan any kind of local business, products business venture. So some wise planning principles that we should take into account here. It's important to make sure that you are not consuming more than your income, that you always have margin, always spend less than you take in, have savings, have margin set aside, because otherwise it's very easy to burn out and run through your resources because you're consuming more than your income. And this is, even if you're producing a lot of, you know, your food and things like that that you don't need to buy anymore, if you're building infrastructure that is costing money, your outflow can be greater than your inflow of income, and you can get in a pinch really quickly. Planning cost overruns. Be very, very conservative in your cost planning. And even if you're not having a homestead business when you're selling to market, kind of plan your homestead venture like a business. In other words, ensure that you're not going into debt to, even if it's in terms of not having enough margin and not having enough cash set aside for those cost overruns, like I mentioned, to help cover unforeseen cost overruns in your budget. So make sure that you have a safe income while you're building any homestead production, whether it's for yourself or whether it's for market. Okay, the next top trap for homesteaders is not being realistic about your limitations. This is one that might not be realized right away, right? Because if you're a go-getter in the modern world, you're all about, you know, the hustle and getting stuff done, and you can go for months or even years not realizing your limitations. But someday you're going to realize, and it's probably going to hit you square in the face, that you have limited resources. Okay, you have a limited amount of time, of energy, of resources, physical resources, and money, and skills too. And this, the last one, is probably one that factors into why things take a lot longer and cost a lot more than you anticipate, because the level of skill that you have for doing a lot of the things that you want to do on the homestead, do-it-yourself style, takes longer, and you may end up having to either learn a new skill that takes time, or you have to hire someone else to do that thing for you after you attempted and failed. So realize you have limited resources, be realistic about those constraints, and plan accordingly. So it's really important that you don't buy a property, move to the country, and immediately buy a bunch of cows, right? The tendency or temptation of a lot of homesteaders is to take on too much too soon, because you're looking ahead in the future to what you want someday, but you're not giving yourself enough time to get there. You want to get it done like in the next year or two. And particularly with the way the economy is going, everybody just kind of wants to get their stuff in a row, right? If things are falling apart, they'd rather have more things, more productive capability on their property, on their homestead, than less. But it's important that we don't kill ourselves by taking on too much too soon. So here's an important principle, and I've heard this relayed from many homesteaders. Don't do anything permanent in the first year you are on a property. Okay, it's important to take time to observe the land, the weather, the plants, the animals, everything. Seasonal differences, how water drains on your property, all these things. So you have an understanding of what your property is like before you start putting in permanent infrastructure of any kind. Okay? And there's a lot of benefits of mobile infrastructure or temporary infrastructure beyond just that of not making a mistake of where you put something permanent. But it's important that you don't jump the gun on some of these things. Go through a full year of being on the property so you can observe and take notes and learn what's going on, so you're making wise, informed decisions and not foolish, uninformed decisions. Here's another one that many homesteaders have told me before, some through doing it the right way and learning from others, and some through trial and error. Very important emphasized piece of wisdom from these homesteaders is only add one animal species at a time, okay, or in short succession. Like, don't get, if you've never raised animals before, don't get chickens and goats at the same time, or even within a couple months, right? Give yourself some time to get used to caring for a particular species, and making sure that you are able to keep them alive and keep them healthy before you then go try to tackle another thing. One of the problems with animals in particular is that, unlike plants, they don't just sit there, right? They like to get out and go places. And even when you have fencing, they like to get out and go places. So the more more species, more animals you put into your operating environment, the more complexity you add and the more things that can go wrong. And so you're potentially adding a lot of risk to yourself of being distracted by trying to manage disaster all the time with too many animals too quickly than you are if you pace yourself more. So that's a really important, highly emphasized lesson that so many homesteaders have told me, and from my own experience as well with the animals that we've raised. Here's another important one. Don't burn yourself out by pushing too hard. I kind of already said this, but Noah Sanders, who does a lot of teaching on low technology cultivation, part of one of the essential pieces of his instruction is talking about having joy in our work, okay? Having joy in the journey, I would say, in a larger sense. Don't push so hard that you burn yourself out and you destroy the joy that you have in what should be an enjoyable journey that we're on. I'd like to share with you just a minute or two of Noah's perspective on this topic. This is from his session at our live training event on low-tech growing.
Well, how long did that take us?
10 minutes.
5-10 minutes, yeah. So then, you see how beautiful that looks, and after you drink a glass of tea or whatever, then you're like, I think I'd like to do another one. But perhaps you stop, and you do another one tomorrow. Tomorrow evening, you do another one. And the next evening, you do another one. And then you're done, and you didn't have to kill yourself to do it. Does that make sense? So you want to, one of the things that we want to remember is because joy brings work ethic, if we can, we want to always stop. We want to start on time within our season so that we can always stop each day while we still have joy. Because if we keep going and greedily try to get more done than we really have strength for, then we lose our joy. And tomorrow, I'm like, my goodness, I am dreading getting out there and doing that last little bit in that garden. So the taking just a little bit at a time, getting out early, not when it's hot like this, doing it with your family and friends, then, you know, it can be a very positive thing.
The next top trap is not planning with your entire family in mind. Okay. It's very easy in our individualistic culture for, you know, the adults, the parents, to be thinking of themselves and to not really think about our kids, particularly in the future of, you know, what do they want? And so it's important to take the gifts and skills of our entire family into account, but also their desires. And so it's important that we include our children in the planning of our homesteads and in whatever ventures we're undertaking in our homesteads, whether that is, you know, what animal should we add next, or what kind of new business venture maybe do we want to do, what do we want to produce to sell to market, these kind of things. Get your children involved with that. Lord willing, they will be taking over the homestead from you someday. So give them some ownership in the decision-making process and the entire venture now and as early as possible, even when they're young. And that will pay long-range, very important dividends in the future. Our live event host, Josh Deal, provides some outstanding perspective on this and how he's implementing this concept with his family. This is from Josh's session on permaculture design.
But I think also our desire for like our children and grandchildren is that we wanted to come into this entire you know, homesteading, farming, permaculture concept with the intentionality of partnering across generations so that we could establish multiple cottage industries, and not just establish the industries, but also to design the system in such a way there might be industries we're not even thinking of, right? So we want to manage, like the woodlots here have not been managed very well. They've just had a patchwork of owners and so forth and clear cuttings and just, you know, all over the place. But we want to manage them in a way so that good sawing timbers can come out. So maybe down the road, my grandchildren will have the timbers they need to build the barns and houses on this property. I may never see those trees in my life, you know, in full maturity, but we need to manage this. And you know, I'm 30 now, but I've only got so many years. I need to get working here. There's a lot to do, not just for me, but for children and grandchildren and beyond. So that's just one example, you know, managing the woodlots. And I may never use those for a lot of my own purposes. Maybe I will some, growing mushrooms or different things in the woods, some medicinals, but they may have other plants, you know, and I want to make sure that that this site, believe it or not, we can partner with nature and we can even improve upon our processes, speeding it up by just simple observation, like the time stacking and the successional stuff I talked about with food forest, you know. Yeah, you can let nature take 100 years to put a forest in your pasture, or you can intentionally plant and chop and drop and mulch and help it along, so to speak, in the early years and speed up that entire process by decades.
Our fifth top trap for homesteaders is not connecting to and building your local community. The reality is because homesteading is so different from modern life, it's very tempting to take our individualistic Western American culture with us. If we're moving to the country, that mindset is very easy to take with us. So don't isolate yourself just because you're beyond rock throwing distance from your neighbors, if that's the case. Make sure you're not isolating yourself because you're just busy with life and you're busy building your homestead and you're busy doing this and doing that. It's a very important, essential, I would say, aspect of your homesteading venture, your homesteading journey, to be connecting with your local community. And this starts out with just the simple understanding that it is very important to build good relationships with your neighbors. Okay. Take time to visit your neighbors and get to know them, just to sit on the porch swing and chat. Understand where they come from, what their knowledge and their experiences, their joys and their pains, their journey, so you understand where they're coming from. And you also understand how you can help meet their needs and vice versa in the future. Another way that you can build community is by taking time to help your neighbors, you know, whether it's putting up hay or during harvest times, like in the old days when everybody would get together and work together to harvest the crops. And a good modern, much more common modern opportunity for working together with your neighbors is helping with construction projects. You know, as the old adage goes, many hands make light work. And so gathering together to help each other when you have projects that you need to get done will not only help them get accomplished faster, and often because of the varied skill set, better, and you'll have better inputs on making decisions on these kind of things, but you'll be building community along the way, and those relationships are what really matter. So it's vital that you connect to your local community. A few thoughts here real quick about community connections and how to form them. Some places you can look to connect with your local community. Gardening clubs are a great one because they tend to be other people that like to grow things and have a high value set on being good stewards of God's creation. And that can be a great way to build community and relationships with others, as well as, you know, preserve our genetic heritage of seeds and other things as well. And also, if you're new to an area, gardening club can be one of the best ways that you can get local specific gardening information, such as the most common pests and other, you know, weather type of information that can be very important to you in your food growing efforts. Another opportunity to not only meet those in your local community and get to know them through relationship, but also to serve your local community, is to be a volunteer firefighter, or if you have the skills to be an EMS, an EMT with an EMS unit. These people tend to be some of the most highly trained people in your community and the most service-oriented people. So if there's any kind of a disaster or hardship in your community, these people often be the ones that you want to know, have a relationship with, and to work with to help meet the needs of others, or maybe you might be the one in need. And so having relationships ahead of time will be very helpful in helping you to meet your need in time of need. Local business groups are a great way to connect with local community leaders. And also, of course, local events and festivals are a crucial way to get plugged in with the local culture, get to know people, and form bonds that will end up, that really form the basis for the social fabric in a local community. You can also, as you get to know your neighbors, start, or maybe there's already an existing homesteaders group that you can join to learn from others about what they're doing. And some of these local homesteader groups that I'm aware of, they will schedule a time like once a month to get together and work on a group project. And so they'll all come together at once somebody's homestead and work on a project where they need manpower to accomplish something. So this is a great way that you can build relationship as well as harness group effort for a greater end. Another important thing that you want to do in building community is to engage in commerce locally. We get trained in our modern economy to value price, the lowest price, and convenience as the top two factors when we make purchase decisions. But it's important to reconnect with our local community and also to rebuild our local economies that we engage in commerce locally. The ways we can do this is by buying locally, which you can't produce yourself. Typically, this is related to food, but it might be to other goods that are made locally. Hire locally, which you can't do yourself. So if you have a project that requires some specialty or skill that you don't have, hire that out locally. And this is the thing that, you know, goes back to the old ways, is that we don't have to exchange dollars all the time. We can barter for goods and services. And even in terms of just sharing with our neighbors, you know, if you pay it forward, so to speak, a lot of times those things will come back to you. So be generous, and generosity will be returned to you. Lastly, I just want to touch on this issue of food freedom really quick, because homesteading is very much interconnected with local food in particular. There's been steady movement at both the state and the federal level to limit food freedom. And with the Farm Safety Modernization Act from a few years ago being implemented now, even more regulations are coming down on small food producers. So this is critical. If you're going to be doing any selling to market, even if it's just, you know, you're not planning it as the main thing that you're doing, you're not having a full-time farm, but as you're part of your homestead production, you're planning on taking excess of some products to market, make sure that you prepare properly in terms of regulatory requirements, and have a legal team ready. And I'm not kidding when I say legal team, because if bureaucrats come after you, it can end your dream of homesteading or farming quite quickly, because the resources they have that you don't have. So I highly recommend that all homesteaders and potential food producers join the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. I've been a member for a great many years, since very early on when they started. Joel Salatin was one of the founding farmers of Farm to Consumer. They defend farmers and food artisans against government regulators. They help to write legislation to increase food freedom. And this has been happening in states all across the country, where legislation they've authored has been picked up by a sponsor, passed in the legislature and signed. In my state of Virginia, we've had a number of these bills passed in the past couple of years. And they also provide consultation to farmers. And, you know, if you pick up the phone and talk to them a couple times a year, your membership would more than pay for itself, because you talk to a lawyer for an hour and you're talking a couple $100, and the membership is less than that. So they have memberships for farmers, consumers, so even your family and friends could join to support their work. And they also have membership for homesteaders, which provides a lot of the services to that they provide to farmers, but at a lower cost to homesteaders. And they also have membership for food co-ops and buying clubs as well. Go to farmtoconsumer.org to learn more about them. I highly recommend you become a member. So I'd like to wrap up this topic of community with some important thoughts from my farmer friend Mike Bravo. This is from a panel discussion on homesteading at our live event that we had, in which Mike gives some really important pieces of perspective.
The American ideal that you're going to go off into the bush and you're going to make it solo is a dangerous and potentially deadly snare. You must have community. You must have like-minded people that can support one another, who can come over and help you bury livestock that die, or when, you know, the 1,500 hay bales that you just stacked gets blown over and all of it's ruined. And I'm sitting on the porch crying, and my wife texts a friend. He comes over to console me. And community is so important as you move forward. Regardless of where you're at in that process, look for like-minded people that have the same kind of vision.
Okay, and with that, I'd like to wrap up the top traps of homesteading and how to avoid them. The top five traps are not having a financial plan, not being realistic about your limitations or taking on too much at once, not taking a long view and looking forward with the future generations in mind, not planning with your entire family in mind, and not connecting to you and building your local economy. Real quick before I wrap up, I just wanted to let you know that the Beyond Off-Grid film that I mentioned is going to be released soon. If you'd like to join our launch team, we'd love to have you on helping getting the word out about that. If you would like to be a supporter, we actually do still need some additional resources to finish up paying for some of the post-production costs as well as the marketing costs for launching the film. We have a lot of great resources and a member site with extended film interviews and homestead site visits that we've done with a lot of these homesteaders that you can learn from as well. So we'd love to have you consider being a supporter of that as well. We also have our Beyond Off-Grid Summit training series we've done, which is both online as well as from our live event training. And I'd like to share the slides from this presentation on top traps for homesteaders with you, as well as a special bonus. And to get that, you can go to beyondoffgrid.com/MEN Summit for Mother Earth News Summit, or you can click on the Beyond Off-Grid graphic on this page to go there. So I'd like to thank Marjorie and Mother Earth News for sponsoring this event and for inviting me to give you this presentation on the top traps of homesteading and how to avoid them. If you have any questions, feel free to contact us via the website, and I look forward to hearing from you in the future. Thanks so much and have a great day.
Well, thanks, Jason, so much for that presentation. If you want to get in touch with Jason there, of course, the button on the right is the way to reach him, and he also mentioned his website a few times. And if you're interested in homesteading, we had a lot of other wonderful presentations. You know, David the Good had a really good one on better gardening through experimentation. David is totally nuts. And then we also had Justin Rhodes with 10 steps to getting your homestead up and running. That's also another one. Patricia Foreman had an excellent one on chickens, and also the Livestock Conservancy on how to build a better chicken, which is all about chicken breeding and selecting the right ones that are going to increase the value of your flock. Highly recommend you catch either one of those presentations. In either way, this is Marjorie Wildcraft, and I'll see you on the next one.